This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, everyone. And good morning to all of you who are coming to us from somewhere else. Good afternoon or good evening, depending on where you are. So this was a decidedly quieter entrance for the final morning of Zango than it would be our custom with Shusa Hosen. So we are ending the 3-month training period. And for those of you who may be joining us more newly, these 3-month intensives take place for us each fall and spring, and our tradition that goes back to the Buddha, and we call it Ango, peaceful dwelling. And during each Ango, we take up some particular aspect of the teaching to focus on, concentrate on. And this Ango, we've been studying the 37 verses of the practice of a Bodhisattva by Togme Tsongpo. And so this morning we come to the final verse. To clear away all the suffering of all infinite beings with sublime knowledge, free of concepts of the three spheres, to dedicate to enlightenment the merit accumulated through these efforts. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. So Tsongpo began with a recognition, first of Avalokiteshvara, bodhisattva, the great bodhisattva of compassion, who is the manifestation, the embodiment of enlightened wisdom that is manifesting through these her 1,000 hands and eyes with implements in each to respond to the needs of the cries of the world. And we began with the recognition of having obtained this precious human body, this vessel which is so difficult to find. And to use that to its full potential, to listen, hear the Dharma, reflect on it, and meditate with diligence day and night. And so now, having come to the conclusion of these verses, but certainly not the conclusion of the Bodhisattva path, to clear away the suffering of all the many beings with sublime knowledge, free of all concepts of the three spheres, and to dedicate all that we do, the merit, the karma, the good effects, the good intentions of all that we do, accumulated through all of our practice, to dedicate that to the well-being of others. That is our practice of the Bodhisattva. And Thubten Chodron, commenting on this, says, we dedicate all of our virtue for full enlightenment for ourselves and others. In particular, we dedicate by reflecting on the purity of the three spheres, which is in this dedication as we offer whatever good we have created, all the good that we've created, that we who are offering and those to whom we're offering it in our mind and in our direct actions, and the purpose of that offering, which is to alleviate suffering, to bring forth happiness and joy, that all of those exist, as she says, by being merely labeled. They come into being because we speak of them. They come into being because we think of them. She says they are empty of having their own inherent nature. They don't exist on their own. And by our reflecting on dependent arising and the emptiness of inherent existence in this way, we can make a great dedication. Because we have that power in our mind to, in a sense, draw from that which has no inherent existence, emptiness, and to create a better world, a clearer mind, a more open heart, we can do that. Like painting a beautiful face in empty space. And then Tsongpo goes on with some epilogues or codas. In music, coda means tale, I think in Italian. In the end of a piece, sometimes the piece ends and then it goes on. There's a little tale, right? The story is completed, but then there's another thought. There's another expression before we're finished. And so he says, relying on what is taught in the sutras and treatises and the words of the great masters, I have composed these 37 bodhisattva practices to benefit those who wish to train on the bodhisattva path. So he's speaking to us. Because my understanding is small and my study is limited, I cannot compose teachings or poetry to please the scholars. Yet, since these are based on sutras and teachings of the great masters, I believe these practices of a bodhisattva are not mistaken. I believe they are true. Nevertheless, since the vast actions of a bodhisattva are difficult to fathom, particularly for one with an inferior wisdom such as mine, I pray to the great masters to consider with patience all of my mistakes, such as contradictions, incoherence, and so on. By virtue of the merit gathered here, by the power of relative and ultimate bodhicitta, may all sentient beings become like the great bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, who dwells neither in the extreme of existence nor in that of peace. And so as I mentioned yesterday at the end of my talk, what I wanted to focus on today was three aspects that I feel like he touches on in these final verses. So humility, this virtue of humility, which is very much considered a virtue in Buddhist practice. And these virtues, as we speak of them in Buddhism, are not like nice things to have when everything else has been put together. They're the thing itself. They're not incidental or in any way ornamental or extraneous. They're in the essence of what we're doing. And so humility, that of the earth, the ground, humus. And looking back at the etymology of these words, in the old French, humility had a connotation of sweetness. What is the importance of humility? Why is that an important virtue? Why is it important on the bodhisattva path, and why is it important as part of bodhicitta, which is your own aspiration to realize enlightenment? Why is it important to you in your own path? What is its function? And how does it come forth? How do you bring it forth? How do you recognize when it's not there? I was thinking of in these verses where Tsongpo speaks of his own inferior wisdom and his limited understanding. And I've seen sometimes where scholars will comment on that kind of language or sentiment expressed by teachers, particularly very well-regarded, highly considered teachers, as a kind of pro forma, a kind of formula. I don't think so, actually. I think he is speaking from his heart. He's not just fulfilling some expected way to show humility, but he's actually humble. It's like in Shu Zosen, where the chief disciple holds up the shepe and says, I feel like a mosquito trying to bite an iron bull. And when I'm talking to the chief disciple beforehand, I say, when you say those words, it should be easy to mean them, right? If this training period has gone well, you should be easily able to connect with those words. And the second virtue I wanted to look at was confidence, humility, confidence. Why is confidence important? That may seem a little bit more obvious, but what seems obvious is always worth examining, because when it seems obvious, we oftentimes won't examine it because it's obvious. But when we begin to look at it, sometimes we see it's not so clear. What gives you confidence in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha? What gives you confidence in yourself? Where does that come from? How do you arouse it? How do you strengthen it, develop it when you feel insecure and doubtful? And then inspiration. Humility, confidence, and inspiration. Where do you find your inspiration? Where does that come from? What have you seen within yourself during these 3 months? Last night when I was speaking to a group of students, and I was asking for folks to, you know, ask questions or make comments, and it was quiet for a while, and I said, come on. I said, this has been 3 months of kicking ass, right? In every direction. And one student stepped forward and says, yeah, my ass has been kicked. And I said, exactly, mine too. So where, when we're getting our ass kicked, do we find our inspiration? How do you cultivate it when you can't find it? I was thinking this morning of aspiration and inspiration, and I thought, I wonder if there's a connection. And then I thought of respiration, breathing. And so I looked, and it wasn't quite as neat as I thought it might be, but inspiration, one of the early origins of the word, is a divine guidance, being influenced by a God. That this inspiration that we experience is, it's as though it's coming from some divinity, some other place, some extraordinary source. And that there is, in its early meaning, a sense of breathing in, blowing into, breathing upon, as though we're sort of receiving a breath, right, of influence, of inspiration, that animates, arouses bodhicitta. And then an aspiration within early meanings was a sense, in the Latin, was a sense of breathing, also breathing into, influencing, seeking, a steadfast longing for some higher goal. And so it's interesting to think of this all in terms of breathing, right? This such essential, ordinary act, which is our first and last in this lifetime. To think of God breathing life into the first humans. And so that's what I wanted to look at, humility, confidence, and inspiration, in particular in relationship to these 3 months and all that we've been studying, that you've been studying. And as you've been thinking about this, relating this, reflecting on it in relationship to your life, to what's going on in our lives, in our world, and there's been a lot going on, to say the least, where are these virtues? Where do you find them? How do they serve you? How do you bring them forth in a genuine way? Not contrived, not pretend, but in a genuine way. How do you practice bringing something forth when it feels small? Why are they important? Okay, so Shoen is going to help steward the those of you who are at home. And I thought, because there's so many of you who are with us but not in the Zendo, if there are enough, that we'll do two there and one here. So we'll go back and forth between the residents and those who are at home or wherever you may be. And remember that there's a slight pause between when I've been speaking and then when you will, those of you who will be speaking, will come on to the screen. So just allow for that. And also, I'd like to encourage those of you who have not given your voice during the ango yet, particularly during these mandos at the end of the session. So if you've been a little bit more on the quiet side, we know that there's something going on in your mind, and we'd like to hear it. So it'd be nice to hear from some of you first.
Okay, so Tose has her hand up.
And she can begin.
Well, first, great appreciation for these questions and this life. All right, this is pretty personal. For me, it starts really with inspiration. And Shoen quoted a Tibetan teacher, the devotional surrender. So you can all hear me, right? So before my eyes open, the first thoughts are taking refuge and a very short metta. And I may spend time with dreams, but just set the dial. It's very, very trained for me. Shugan, it's such a big question. So that's the launching. I'm pairing something that's so big into like a little something. And then I put on, I think there's a koan where the bell rings, you put on your robe. And then I put on the clothing of, I'll call it my faith life. Sit, study, practice, go for a walk, say metta. I mean, I'm just cultivating a field. And because I've got this suit on, it reminds me when my father was teaching me how to swim, you know, that thing you wear, not the life preserver, but the tube. And so the tube is on me, and I have to let go and relax into the tube. It's so I have to like really relax, like really. And so there's the humility of letting go into that support, which I have pronounced to my being upon awakening. And there's the confidence, because it's not mine. It's we're together. So that's generally it.
Okay. All right, thank you. Okay, Shoen?
Seiyu has a question.
So when I think about humility, I think about pride also. Because, you know, being a sentient being, I think that, you know, with my conditioning, I think about myself first. And I'm, you know, I'm ultimately have a fair amount of insecurities. And pride is one of those things that helps me to, you know, pretend like I don't have them. And, you know, so humility, you know, for me has been, you know, I heard a long time ago, it's not humiliation. But there is, you know, my aspiration that grounds me. That what am I here? What do I want? How do I want to live this life? And where is it that I can serve? When I come back to that, then, you know, a lot of the trouble goes away, or at least a lot of the things that I perceive it as obstacles. You know, it's not, you know, if I can step forward and be in the light, if that's a way that I can serve, my humility allows me to do that. Because if I'm not humble, then I think that I'm not really worthy, that I should just like sort of collapse in on myself and try to find some corner and sit there and hide. You know, so I have to work with those two things, like, you know, because it's safer in the corner. And, but I have things to offer. I have experiences that can be beneficial to a lot of people. And if I don't step forward, if I don't have the courage to step forward, then I can't serve.
Okay. How do you, what's the difference between humility and insecurity or self-doubt?
Well, I think that the humility is taking the step forward. Taking a step forward and not, you know, requiring a particular outcome. You might aspire for there to be a particular outcome, but you just step forward and you serve.
Can you speak in? So what I asked was, how do you understand there's difference between humility and insecurity, having self-doubt?
Well, I think that the insecurity is a type of is not humility. I think the insecurity is thinking that, you know, it's a created identity again. You know, it's the self arising.
Okay, and just as we go on, in my bringing up these three different qualities, it's, you know, you can, if you want to just focus on one, it's not necessary to like take them all in. If you want to, you can, but it's also fine just to take up one aspect. Okay, so I'd like to keep that question also on the table. How do you discern the difference between humility and insecurity? How do you see them as different? How are they different? Okay, is somebody in the room? Yuko?
So I've had a lot of opportunities for developing humility these past 3 months, more than I would have asked for. I would have liked to be able to come up and speak about confidence, but what I've been experiencing is the idea of humility is not to be trying to boost this preconceived idea that I would like to have of myself. And so to let that drop. And the insecurity is like, I can't do it, or I don't have the ability. That's what insecurity feels like for me, that I can't do it. But humility is like what you have to cultivate when you try to do it and it doesn't come out the way you would like it to. Mm-hmm. So.
What, when you're experiencing humility, mm-hmm. What do you see is often happening or usually happening in those moments that brings that forth? Like, where do you find yourself? Or what do you find yourself in relation to?
Well, I got some practice this morning, and I feel like where I find myself is to be able to say this isn't like how to get out of yourself. Mm-hmm. So if I'm like locked into this tightness. Mm-hmm. That's, I think, the humility is being able to be more expansive in that.
Okay, so you're talking about this morning. Did something happen this morning that brought that up?
Well, you had a good catch.
So you're talking about when you were...
When I brought you the... Okay. Yes.
So...
And yes, so not to get, like, involved in that and just say, okay, something happened, and that's not me, and... Yeah, but to be able to just feel like I'm here to serve, I'm not here to create a sense of myself.
Okay. So what I was thinking of was, think of moments where we feel humbled, which sometimes can also be come along with awe, mm-hmm. when we're in the presence of something that is vast, boundless, infinite, and we feel our own insignificance, you know, we feel our smallness, or we just feel the expansiveness of something, like the night sky, like the ocean, like the Dharma. And so there's something going on, right? Because we're here in this, you know, seemingly finite body and mind, and having our own perspective on things, and then we're in the presence of something, right? Which there's the felt sense of something so much larger, right? Larger than we know. And so, and that may be, I think, for many of us, an easier experience of humility, right? In the presence of something very large. I think most of us, any those of us who have spent time out in nature, particularly in difficult circumstances of weather or conditions or lostness or just the arduousness of being in the elements and feeling the power of a mountain or a river, right? And our own relation to that in that moment. And so if you can identify with that at all, can you relate that to what happened in this moment, right? Because we could just look at that as a mistake, right? That was just a mistake, or it was just an accident, right? Something, a slip. But you talk about it in terms of humility. So was there something that you were in the presence of?
Yes. I'm in the presence of the Dharma. I'm in the presence of this practice. I'm in an amazing situation here. And so that I feel that so strongly, mm-hmm. and so that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, I also wonder if there's, because you were just offering something, right? Just being a Jisha. And that slip, that minor moment, right, might stand in relation to, you know, what we aspire to, you know, or just our desire to serve, our desire to, mm-hmm. you know, do something well. Mm-hmm. And then when that something shifts, right, and there's a kind of a stumble, right, and to, in a simple way, to experience that moment, right, that vulnerability in the presence of an intention or an aspiration, right, and to be humbled, you know, by something that, you know, relatively speaking, is quite simple, quite small. And yet because of what that might mean to us, or our desire, our intention, might bring forth that feeling of humility. Okay. Cajun?
For me, humility is knowing that while I'm striving to become a Buddhist, that I have flaws, and that I have failed like thousands and thousands of times, and that I'm going to continue to fail, even though I strive and set intents, and I'm in the struggle. I know that I'm going to fail. So that for me is what's humility. Confidence is actually doing things, even though I know I'm going to fail, even though I might have fear about doing something I've never done before, or, you know, just know that I'm going to struggle to actually do things and to get up from failure, is what, where I feel confidence. Like, okay, I've failed thousands of times, but I'm still in it. I'm still in the ballpark. I'm still striving. And that gives me confidence. And the inspiration for me is, has to do with the imperative. The vows that I took were living vows. And so that's one imperative, is that I've made those vows. And the other imperative is being there for others. So there might be something that I'm afraid to do, but I get inspired because of my love for somebody else. And I'm gonna do it even though I'm afraid, and I know that I'm subject to failure. I am inspired by my love for someone and being of service to someone. So that's it.
Okay. When you're in a moment of failure, if you really look at that carefully, what's actually happening?
I would say it's that suddenly I have awareness, you know, like I'm, you know, for me, like I'm failing and it's happening, but lots of times I don't see it. But when I see it, then it becomes clear that trouble has happened, that I'm doing something that I perceive to be outside of my vows, my intent, and what I want to be in the world. So it becomes a failure when I see it.
So failure, as I hear you, is there's a moment where that what's happening is outside of or apart from something, right? So if we have an intention that is not fulfilled, when exactly? Because a failure, when we think about failure, we think about, in that instance, it sounds like in this moment, right? And if we think of a complete failure, where something is apart from our intention forever, like how does that happen? Is that even possible? You know, so how words and meaning frame things, in a sense, freeze things. Freeze, F-R-E-E-Z-E. Freezes things, right? In a particular moment, in a particular view. But if we see that moment, I mean, you know, how would we define failure in Zazen, right? And so if you're failing at something thousands of times and you keep going, can those rightfully be called failures anymore? Are they something else? Are they just the path? In other words, you know, it's like when you, you know, when we do something over and over, it begins to lose its power. And sometimes that's become because it's becoming habitual. But sometimes because that framing has lost its power, right? It's no longer needed. Okay? Anybody else?
I hope you can hear me. I'm speaking from London in England. This ongo has coincided with a pretty difficult period for me in my professional life. I was promised to have a particular role that was very high profile and a so-called important job, but it's actually turned out not to be quite as I expected. And it was very difficult for me. But as we've worked through the 37 verses, I've used that dharma to try to put into context what's happening and to use it, I think, as you described, Roshi, as the teacher on my head, and to put my situation into a context where I'm seeing these obstacles as opportunities to learn. So I've moved slowly from a situation that could be thought of being humiliation to one of humility. And I think it's only now, as I've literally, while I'm speaking, that I realize the relationship between that and confidence, because the humility brings a confidence and it's a wider perspective and a higher purpose. My job's important, but following the practice is becoming more important to me. So I'm actually, I've become grateful for this situation. And just before I stop speaking, I apologize because I've said this to other people in the Sangha. I just really want to thank you and the monastery and the Sangha so much for the miracle of being able to encounter the Dharma from this distance. I was really hoping to be back in New York, but because of COVID, I can't be. But I'm so grateful, and I really hope that you continue with this, because you know the conditions are there for me to have encountered the Dharma, and I don't want to lose that. So thank you so much, and to everybody for everything. Thank you.
Thank you. You know, I think it's such an interesting to think about the relationship and to examine this relationship between humility and confidence, you know, and how, you know, that's why I thought it was worthwhile to look at the relationship between humility and insecurity, right? And where does our confidence come from? So Cajun talked about doing something over and over, even knowing that we might fail or stumble, that we might doubt ourselves, there might be insecurity. You know, that none of these qualities are absolute. None of them, you know, can completely occupy our being. In other words, we may feel completely lacking of something, but that can't be true. That's not the way reality works. Everything is always present. And everything's present in us. And so it's when something is lacking, it just means it's not in our view, or it's, we're not sort of in a perceivable contact with it. And so when we recognize that something is really important, that we need something, how it helps us, then we can learn how to, in a sense, mine situations like a disappointment in your professional life. You know, and with your mind, and not through deception, but on the contrary, through honesty. Not by pretending that everything is okay when inwardly you feel like it's not, but starting with that inward feeling, things are not okay, right? This is not what I expected. This is not a good thing. That's where you start, because that's the one true thing at that moment. And then how do you, recognizing, you know, that you need, that there are certain things that you need within yourself to move forward, but they may not seem readily available. How do you draw upon those, right? How do you find those within yourself? What can you do in your mind, and what can you do with your body, right? That actually brings those forward. You know, it's really pointing to the dynamic quality of the path. You know, and that with aspiration, with vow, that it's continually bringing us back to the things we already know, the practices we've already learned, but we have to actually engage them. Right? how about Emily, who has not, we've not heard from?
Thank you. So this is mostly about inspiration, but all three of those words made me think of this book that I love, that one of the pages of I used to have hung above the altar. This book, Unsui, if you haven't read it, it's this little book of this guy who was at a training monastery in Japan in like 1910 or something, and then decades later, while he was dying, he drew all these little cartoons about his year, whatever, at this training monastery. And someone compiled this book and went to interview him and wrote down what all the little cartoons are about. And I found that very inspiring, because it is just like saturated with humility. It's very charming. The little facial expressions on the little guys are so like human and relatable. It's like day like 111, like the monk will be punished for his laziness yesterday, and he's like standing there with his head down and the head monks are there and they look like very angry. They're like holding a stick, like
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Why does seeing humility in somebody else inspire you?
I think it inspires confidence, because obviously what he was doing at that time was so difficult, but because he, you know, presumably did it out of a love for the Dharma and a desire to work at, I'm assuming, his home temple after the training monastery, but it was hard, and he doesn't pretend like it wasn't hard. Like, every day was this very human experience, mm-hmm. and some of them were difficult.
Right. Yeah. So we all know how we have been and are inspired by the examples of others. Some of you spoke about that this morning in Open Sozan. You know, which is why it's so important to practice within Sangha and just to be alert in our lives, because we're so frequently coming into contact with people, with strangers, in simple moments, fleeting moments, where we see somebody's example. And they're not providing an example. They're just living their lives. They're just responding. They're just being themselves in that moment. It's not contrived. And that's the example, right? Before we go to Kenshu, let's take one more from inside. Roxanne?
So when you mentioned these words yesterday, humility, confidence, inspiration, I don't know why, but immediately the image of an internal combustion engine came into my mind. It was like... inspiration is the spirit, or the gas and the fuel. It's why we practice. And we inject that into our cylinders, our body and mind, our life. And we, with confidence, compress it into practice. We make inspiration real, and then we realize.
I'm waiting to see how combustion energy is humble.
Yeah. Well, it is. Yeah. Well, we realize humility. Which is realizing that the self is not so important. And maybe we have a small flash of insight, which is like a spark, and boom, we are on our way.
Okay, you're a poet, so we'll allow you that stretch. It reminds me of years ago. We were doing a retreat in the Inwood Park at the northern end of Manhattan, where there's actually an old growth forest, and it was part of the Earth Initiative, and we were doing some practices, and people went off into the woods, and somebody came back, and somebody was talking, and she said, you know, in the midst of these old growth trees, she said, I felt so insignificant, but not without influence. And I thought that was such a perfect way, a beautiful way of expressing the truth, right? That we, in a sense, we are insignificant. We just are one person or one community, you know, almost invisible in relation to the whole world and all of its concerns. Our one fleeting life, you know, can seem so insignificant, and there is that sense of humility, right? And yet, we are not without influence, not without impact. And so I thought it was just a nice expression of how those both not only go together, but need each other. Kenshu?
As I consider humility, I'm aware that many years ago in my early religious studies, there was a quote from St. Thomas More simply saying that humility is truth. And as my aspiration is to be able to see clearly and to see myself clearly and to be open to the possibility of the next layer of the onion to be revealed when I'm ready, to be open to something that a weakness that I may have or what have you. It's just a continuing effort to just be aware and to be honest and to see clearly, and at the same time not attach to that aspiration in the sense that I feel defeated by not succeeding or becoming aware of something that's been in my life for 60 years that I've just become aware of now. As far as the confidence aspect, there in our reading on the 37 verses, there was a discussion about the four faiths, and one of which is third of a fourth is having so much experience with the effectiveness, if you will, of the Dharma to have a very strong faith and a strong confidence that it is possible and that I can continue.
Okay. You know, I think of the passage I read of Dogen yesterday where he talked about, you know, we cannot force. He was talking about the way, and he said, we cannot force this. And you mentioned about, you know, when the time is right, when you are ready. And we don't necessarily know when we are ready, right? We often think we do. And in a sense, there's some truth to that. But in terms of, you know, the readiness for an opening or a release or an insight, that tension, that important tension between the effort that we need to bring forward, that continuous practice, and yet for that not to become aggressive, which is based in the idea that, you know, I will decide when I'm ready. I'm ready now, you know, and I will take this because I'm ready, is not only suffering, but it's not understanding the path. In the same sense that when we fail, when we sort of decide that we have failed within practice, and can feel very clear about that, very resolute about that, that has to be based in some standard of measurement, right? And that invariably in that discernment, there is something very important we are not understanding about the path, which makes it possible for us to see ourselves as failing, right? And which we think is valid, but actually there's something that we do not understand, right, about the path. And that's what we need to come back to. But I wanted to ask you a question, Kenshu. How do you, because you started talking about humility, how do you recognize within yourself in moments when you are not humble? What are the signs of that?
Typically, my expression and thinking tends to be outwardly focused. So it's you that have the problem. It's you that are wrong. It's you that hurt me. And so if I'm not aware, I can go down that road.
Okay. Thank you.
Next is going to be Laura.
In moments when I feel acutely aware of my lack of understanding or integration, I think it takes confidence not to kind of despair or be self-critical, but to remember that I am practicing and I'm just where I am. And when Kenshu just was talking about faith, I think that kind of confidence might be the same as faith.
Mm-hmm. But what is that confidence? What is it made of?
I think it's faith that the and acceptance too, and patience.
Mm-hmm. What builds your confidence?
Practice, I think, returning to it and doing it.
Right. When we are doing that very thing. Right. And so when we think about when we're caught in insecurity, self-doubt, in that moment, we're not doing that thing. What we're doing is insecurity and self-doubt. That's the activity of that moment, is the insecurity about something, right, that we were doing or could do, but we're not actually doing it. And that power of within that insecurity or self-doubt to turn towards the thing itself and do it, like breathe again, right? Take another step, right? Wake up and open your eyes again. And that in that, you know, even if this insecurity is still there, there is your manifesting confidence, right? Your faith in your capacity to do that one thing. And that the nature of karma is that strengthens, that becomes stronger. And that's why the repetition of practice is so essential, that we come back again and again and again, day by day, because that which we're doing gets stronger and stronger. And those things that we no longer do start to fade, right? They necessarily will grow weaker and weaker, right? Because that's the nature of things. And that's why there has to be practice. We have to actually do, you know? So sometimes people get very frustrated with the things in their lives that are happening. And as a practitioner, there's a sense of what's going on, but they're really just getting caught in things. And very often is that as those things loom larger, the actual doing of practice begins to recede. The doing of the thing that will help them actually is fading, right? And that's part of the gumption that we have to find within ourselves is in those moments to do that thing which may be the hardest, right, which is to go to that cushion, right, or to turn towards this mind, because we know in some part of ourselves that is the true thing that will actually serve us well, that will shift, right? Okay.
So we spoke about humility and insecurity. So if I think about them in terms of positions and movement, there's instant division, and at the same time as there's division, then there's an insecurity, sorry, there's instant division, and there's an attempt at movement to regain the unity. So if I think about it in terms of positions, like insecurity is as soon as I've created that separation, then I'm down here and I'm constantly looking for something. So it could be I'm not good enough in some way. So then I'm going to look to you, for example, okay, give me that, give me that, give me that. But that's never, it's only ever going to be temporary. And so seeing that, wait, I've created the division and the, and then the movement, that can really help. Just like, you know, just take one little piece out of that, out of that movement. And I think like the humility, it's almost the opposite way. It's like, if I think about maybe arrogance, you know, I can sometimes say that, you know, arrogance, after a while, you know, maybe my arrogance is like a poor metaphor. It's like, okay, I'm putting something underneath me. It's propping me up, propping me up, propping me up. I'm getting bigger and bigger, but it's all based on nothing really. And then, you know, somebody or something comes along, you know, and it's almost like they or I or something knocks that precarious perch down. And, you know, so maybe when Kenshu said that humility is truth, maybe there's a return into that, like, oh, like, look what I did. I built all of that up. I thought it was doing me good. And so there's that sort of like release that comes with humility. It was like, oh, I didn't need any of that. You know, and then.
But what is, because truth is a big word. In practice, what does that mean? When you said you come back to truth, you come back to what?
I don't know what truth is, but.
But what do you come back to?
Yeah, so what do I come back to? Coming back to that, that experience, because I can tell myself intellectually that I'm not separate, but it's like retraining that whole body. And so there's a point in which you can just, whatever it is, like 1 second, 5 seconds, like you put that down, or I put that down, and everything's okay. I didn't disappear. And coming back to that, I don't know if that's what you're looking towards. Or...
Yeah, and in that moment, where are you? You're where you've always been. Right? Whereas when you're building that or reaching up or dividing, you're still there. But the mind, right, creates a world that's somewhere else, right? That can never ultimately work, right? And so, you know, to think about this on the Bodhisattva path of so many moments of feeling humbled or insecure, you know, not having the capacity, not having confidence. And what's actually happening in all of those moments is there's a whole lot of activity going on in our mind. That's where it's like a bottleneck, right? That we're living in a world that we've created in our mind that may be about something, but it's not no longer connected to that thing. And so to consider the power of what we're developing in just mindfulness, you know, of learning how to return to that truth. And I don't know what truth is either. But this is true. I know that. And this can be this very moment. This moment can be, you know, infinitely large. And so, you know, when we let go of an attachment, we're letting go of a world we've created, right, that is taking us away from that one true thing. And then we return, or we already have returned in that letting go. And there may still be questions and confusion, but we are where we need to be, right, to find our confidence, to find our inspiration, right? It never comes from somewhere else. Even when we see an example of someone, it's not really coming from that person, right? Because the confidence you feel is in you, right? They're like a catalyst.
Mustafa.
Hello. Good evening from Cyprus. First of all, I was following the monastery since it became online, and I would like to send my gratitude to my teachers and the Sangha. It was very precious to follow the teachings from miles away. And for these three virtues, when I was thinking of them, I think that there is one thing that gathers them together, and I feel that it is the faith. And why it is the faith? Because I feel that when we are faithful into something that is greater than ourselves, but we are still part of this, but it is greater than ourselves, you start to feel that, you know, something is backing up you. So there is a confidence. Then you feel inspired because you are practicing for something greater. And it's also make you humble because, you know, the things that are happening is not always related to you, you know, so that you don't feel, you know, you feel humble. So I think that the faith and the practice them, gathers them together. So these are my thoughts. And I wanted to say thank you for Shugen and for all the Sangha for putting all this together. So thank you.
Thank you. You know, what you speak of, I think, is so important, and it's probably as old as humanity, which is that not only that sense of something greater, but the need for that. That we need to experience something larger than ourselves in order to fully be able to understand ourselves. Because that demands that it brings us into contact with something that is larger than just our physical body, our thoughts. And that, you know, even in the you know, secular studies of happiness by psychologists, social scientists, and so on, you know, what are the ingredients of happiness, right? What's the magic? What's the key? That the central element always in every study I've ever read was essentially that one's life has to include or be about something that is larger than what we perceive as ourself. And that without that, you know, it's sort of like as we get older, or just if we live lives that are more, you know, that are fearful or for whatever reasons are just, you know, sort of more confined. And then that continues to become more and more of a trajectory sort of towards, you know, sort of turning in, closing in, that the world becomes more remote and smaller. Our world becomes smaller and smaller and smaller, that it's a kind of dying, you know. It's interesting how when people go into nursing homes, that oftentimes they actively begin to die, right? Because too often there's not real life there, right? And so how we need that, you know, in order to live. And that, so what do we as practitioners come into contact with, which is that which is so much greater than ourselves? Well, we come into contact with the Dharma. We come into contact with our mind, right? Which we begin to realize in some way is so much larger, certainly than what we thought, with what we imagined. We come into contact with the path, which we sooner or later realize is much, much larger than we imagined it to be. We come into contact with our own capacity, you know, our very humanness, which we begin to realize is so much larger than we thought it was, right? I remember when I was doing so many years of koan study with my teacher, and so many hundreds and hundreds of times going in and presenting my understanding, my teacher saying, no, that doesn't reach it. Go back to your seat. And for so many times, I felt like a failure. I was failing, you know, and the misery of that, And then I began to really look at it differently. And I realized when something is not clear, that's what it means. I'm not clear about something. There's something that is not hidden, but has not yet been revealed to me. And that recognition was in real alignment with why I came here in the first place. So then I realized, oh, this is helping me to see that which is appears hidden, but is not, right? That is helping me to let go of something, which I may not even recognize I'm holding on to. And that began to transform my relationship, my experience of those rejections as encouragements, right? I thought what my teacher was saying was, go back to your cushion until you get it right. That wasn't what he was saying. He was saying, go back to your cushion and so that you can fulfill your vow. Go back to your cushion because that's what you asked for, right? That's what you want, isn't it? So, maybe one more, Shona.
Thank you for letting me ask the question. So for me, this is kind of new, but what I seem to struggle in my life with is easily becoming overconfident that I know what's going on and that I've got a handle on it. And as soon as that happens, I learn quite quickly that I didn't. So if I take the time to just say, hey, you don't know everything here, things seem to work out better than just being confident that I know something.
Yeah. Well said. you know, I was asking Kent you earlier, how does he know when arrogance arises? You know, it's really important, and he spoke about it in terms of, you know, seeing how he's responding to others, but just experiencing that feeling of pride arise. We learn something, we do something, somebody comments and says something, and there's just that little lift, right? Something's rising up within us. And to just see that, right? And to not freak out, right? It's not a crime, but just to see it as, right, a building up of something. And it's interesting how inevitably within arrogance, that in a sense, arrogance stands on the ground of insecurity. Why else would we need arrogance? You know, why else would we need to be prideful? What is its purpose? What is it serving? You know, to build up, you know, to stand upon or cover over a sense of insecurity and self-doubt. And so just to see those relationships within ourselves and then to see how they play out. So when we see ourselves judging other people a lot and harshly, you know, to see in that there's insecurity in that, you know, as well as arrogance and pride. And to really see how those fuel each other, you know, they kind of depend on each other. And that the more clear we can become about that, and it's like, okay, so what's underneath all of that, right? What are we afraid of? You know, being ourselves, not fulfilling an idea that we have of something, you know, that may be false to begin with. You know, that's why we keep coming back and taking refuge in the Dharma. That which is true, which is not created by anybody, right? It's not something that is built up, right? And so that we can keep sort of drinking from that water and gaining the confidence that we don't have to do that, right? And as you very well said, you know, that when we observe how it works when we're coming from that place of not so much confidence, you know, thinking that I know everything is a kind of false confidence, right? True confidence doesn't have to think that thought, right? It doesn't think that thought because true confidence knows that we don't know everything. You know, true confidence is, you know, walking alongside humility, That's what's so beautiful about these qualities, is how they feed each other, they complement, they groom in a sense, and develop each other. And that we can see the signs of their counterparts, our pride, our insecurity, and use those. Put those to use. You know, we don't have to be afraid of those things or feel bad about them. But when we really pay attention to them and let them bring us in closer and see more carefully what's actually happening here, right? Why do I need this arrogance? Why do I need this insecurity, right? What purpose is that, like what desire is that fulfilling? And when we look at it that way, it's not so seductive, right? It's not so convincing. And I think then in that we find our inspiration. And so just to sort of bring this to a completion for today, you know, this text that we've been studying in all these teachings in the Mahayana on the Bodhisattva path, they're lifetime teachings. You know, and so to study these two, there's a story of, I think I told earlier, of a great master in the past who studied Shantideva's Guide to a Bodhisattva Way of Life, you know, every day, and that when he came to the end of it, he would weep, right, that it was over, until he realized he could just start again, and then he was overjoyed. And there are texts like that. There are texts like that for me. That I sometimes, as soon as I complete it, I actually just begin again. And some that I put down for a spell, knowing that it's, I keep it close. I keep it on a shelf close to me because I know that I will soon come back to this. And I think for each of us, there are such teachings that you really recognize as lifetime teachings, teachings that you need to contemplate and reflect on and come back to again, right? And see them anew and see more and, in a sense, test ourselves against them. You know, use them as sort of calls from within and from beyond to sort of bring us into reflection upon how, where we're at, you know, and how we're practicing. And because they're so large and so demanding, right? There's nothing wishy-washy about these teachings. They really speak from confidence. They speak from this place of great faith in us, right? In us, that they speak to us so strongly, because the teachings have complete confidence that we are that person, right, that they are speaking to. We are, that what they are speaking about is who we are, our very nature. And of course, this is a kind of a, you know, a backwards way talking about the Dharma, as though the Dharma has a consciousness and is, you know, doing something. But when these teachers compose these, put together these teachings, which are coming through their own experience, but that experience is also inseparable from the experience of all those before them and around them, and from their own deep study of the teachings, that when we encounter one true teaching like this, we're really encountering this whole sangha of beings, of enlightened masters and practitioners. And so that's just my way of saying to continue studying and practicing and recognizing when you encounter a teaching that has that kind of affinity for you, right? That's not an accident. There's a karmic thread, you know, that you have discovered in that. And it may last you a lifetime, or it may just be that for a while it serves its particular purpose for you as it's helping you develop and bring something forward. I also just wanted to acknowledge that we are, first of all, to acknowledge those of you Sangha members who helped so much with the Ango, Angaku and Ikkyo and Taksei, MK, Kondo, Hojin Sensei, for leading us in the art practice. And for those of you who did different teachings with the Sangha and led morning Zazen and are continuing to do that, it's just to thank you for giving yourself to the Sangha during the Ango and helping to make it so bountiful. And that as we conclude the Ango, we're going into winter, right? Which is, particularly in the Northeast, is for many folks not an easy time, in the best of times, not an easy time. And so this is not exactly the best of times. It's a hard time, right? It's a challenging time. And it's also a time where there are lots of openings. And so as we go into the winter training, you know, we will continue to be doing this. Hojin and I were beginning to talk this morning of, you know, how to continue to meet you and to work together and to, you know, think about what is needed during the next 3 months, in which there will probably be more solitude, more quarantining, more isolation, and less of the abundance that has been during Ango, because the winter training period has a purpose, and part of its purpose is a sort of stepping back a little bit from the intensity of Ango. We do that here in our own schedule, and to relax a little bit, to continue practicing, but to intentionally relax the intensity so that when we come back in the spring, we're renewed and refreshed and ready for that. And so it does have that purpose. And so we all need that. I need that. and at the same time, we need to hang together. We need to keep practicing and to stay close during this period of time. And so I just wanted to say that, give voice to that. And that if you, you know, I think we'll be sort of putting our ears to the rail to be thinking of and listening for how can we do that? What would be helpful? You know, we'll continue doing some of those things we have been doing, but what else might be helpful in terms of coming together and ways to do that, but also the practice of solitude. You know, to really use the winter light, the winter cold, the season of winter, which is such a very special kind of season, particularly in the Northeast, you know, and that does lend itself, sort of creates a particular kind of atmosphere, you know, that is sort of inwardly, you know, sort of retreating, a little bit quieter. It's not so much out like spring and summer. And so also to use those qualities of winter in a good way, not towards isolation, but towards solitude. You know, not towards, you know, depressed states, but more towards quiet states, calm states. And so share your ideas if you have thoughts about that, and we will be in touch. We'll be in contact. So please take good care of yourselves, all of us, and your practice. And it's been so good to have you with us today and this week, and those of you who are with us throughout the Ango. And it's such a pleasure and a wonderful thing to have, you know, made contact with some of you who live so far away and that have never not been here yet. We hope that day comes. And that to know that, you know, some little bits of what we're doing here is helping you, that's wonderful, right? That's why we're here. And so please keep showing up, all right? And thank you, everyone, for the Ango, for this period of training. and let us appreciate how fortunate we are to have this precious human body and this larger body of the Sangha. Right? We should, as Dada Roshi used to say, we should not take this lightly, but really appreciate what we have. So, thank you, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as meditation cushions, incense, malas, liturgical instruments, books, and more, visit the monastery store at monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.